Okay, I want to try a little experiment with you, just for a second. Close your eyes. We're going to press this giant reset button on how we think about time.
Going back to the glory days,
Way back. I want you to forget the cloud. Forget about, 60 series GPUs, forget AI, and definitely forget scrolling through endless feeds on a little glass rectangle. We're going back to an era where your entire world was inside a chunky black plastic cartridge.
A simpler time for sure, but if you look closely, a much more pixelated one.
Exactly. But we're not just talking about video games today. We're talking about a lifestyle. You know that friend you had growing up, the one who was a little edgy, talked really fast, and told you to stop hanging out with that safe, boring plumber because it was time to break the sound barrier?
I think I know exactly who you're talking about. We're talking about Sega.
We are talking about Sega.
Yeah.
And specifically, we're diving into this really fascinating retrospective piece. It's called The Sound of the Blue Sky by Majid from the Tekken Army.
And it's great because it really treats Sega not just as a nostalgia trip, but as a business case study.
Right.
Because when you look at the numbers, I mean, the story is just staggering. This is a company that, at its peak, held 65% of the US market.
Yeah.
65%.
Wow. They were totally dominant. They were the cool kids.
And yet, somehow, the story ends with them making games for the very rivals they tried to crush.
It is the ultimate how did we get here story.
Yeah.
So our mission for this deep dive is to trace that exact arc, the incredible rise, the catastrophic fall, and the really surprising reinvention.
It is. And honestly, it starts earlier than most people think. We tend to jump straight to the
Oh,
Genesis,
the Mega Drive, yeah.
right, if you're outside the US. But Majid's article points out that Sega's home console journey actually began way back in 1983.
With the SG-1000, which, I'll be honest, I had never even heard of before reading
Most
this.
people haven't. And talk about bad timing. Sega launched the SG-1000 on the exact same day that Nintendo launched the Famicom.
Ouch. That is like, I don't know, releasing a new search engine the same day Google launches.
It's basically that, yeah. It was their first shot, but it was just immediately swallowed by Nintendo's shadow. But, the interesting thing about Sega is they didn't just fold. They
No.
followed up with the Master System. Now, from a hardware perspective, the Master System was technically superior to the NES. It had better graphics, better sound.
So this is the part that always gets me. If the machine was better, why do we all remember blowing into Nintendo cartridges and not Sega ones from that era?
Well, in a fair market, maybe it would have won, but this wasn't a fair market. And this is where the business reality just hits hard. Majid points out that Nintendo had these ironclad third-party exclusivity
It's
deals.
ironclad. That sounds like lawyers were involved.
Heavily. The contract basically said if you made a game for Nintendo, you couldn't make it for anyone else for 2 years.
Wow.
It effectively locked all the hit makers, the people making Mega Man, Castlevania, completely out of the Master System.
So you build a Ferrari, but nobody's allowed to sell you gas. That's
Yeah.
incredibly frustrating.
It was suffocating. But here's where the story gets really weird and interesting, and this is a detail from the source that just caught me off guard.
Okay.
While the Master System was struggling in the US and Japan, it found legendary success in Europe and specifically Brazil.
Brazil.
Brazil. It's a total anomaly. Sega partnered with a local toy company there called Tectoy, and since Nintendo didn't have an official presence, Sega just became the video game company.
So while kids in the US are all playing Mario, kids in Brazil are growing up with Alex Kidd.
It goes even deeper. The source mentions that in Brazil, the Master System is still manufactured to this day.
Wait, hold on. You mean brand new units? You can walk into a store right now and buy one.
Brand new to this day. It's this bizarre, immortal piece of hardware in one specific market.
That is wild. It's like finding out that Betamax won the format war, but only in Australia or something.
Precisely. But obviously, Sega wasn't content with that. They wanted the US market, they wanted the big prize.
And that brings us to 1988, the Mega Drive, or as we knew it, the Genesis.
This was the turning point. Sega realized they couldn't just be slightly better. They had to be different. The goal was to bring the arcade experience home.
Right. Nintendo was for the living room.
What?
Sega was for the kid who wanted that arcade grit and speed.
And this is where the marketing genius comes in. We have to talk about Tom Kalinske.
The CEO of Sega of America. And he wasn't even a tech guy, was he? He came from Mattel. He sold Barbie dolls.
Which was exactly what they needed. He understood branding. He didn't just market a console, he declared war.
Oh, yeah. Sega does what Nintendo.
It's still one of the most famous, most aggressive slogans ever.
It's calling them out by name.
It had to be. It was a positioning statement. It was telling you, hey, you're not a little kid anymore. You need the cool adult alternative.
And to sell cool, you need a face. You need an icon. Because, let's be honest, their old mascot, Alex Kidd, he wasn't exactly striking fear into Nintendo's heart.
No, definitely not. They needed a hero. And the source breaks it down. They explicitly did not want a plumber. They wanted fast. They wanted edgy.
Enter Yuji Naka and Naoto Oshima.
The creators of Sonic the Hedgehog.
Mm.
And if you think about Sonic as marketing, he's just brilliant. He's blue, like the Sega logo. He's fast to show off the processor.
And he had attitude. That little finger wag on the title screen, that was everything.
It was. And Kalinske made the huge call to bundle Sonic with the Genesis, give the game away for free.
Which must have been controversial, giving away your best product.
It was. But it worked. Sales just exploded. Majid notes this was the first time Nintendo ever felt, you know, true, terrifying competition.
So they're on top of the world. They have the market share, the mascot, the cool factor. But the source calls this next part strategic missteps. It sounds like success became the problem.
Success can be blinding. You think everything you touch is gold. The industry was getting ready for the next big leap, right? 2D to 3D polygons.
PlayStation and the N64 were on the horizon.
Exactly. But Sega tried to squeeze every last drop out of the Genesis instead of moving on.
We're talking about the add-ons, the Sega CD and the 32X.
Right. And it's easy to see now why it was a bad idea, but they were trying to get people to buy these expensive attachments for their old console to make it, like, kind of next gen.
I remember the pictures. It was the Genesis with the Sega CD on the bottom and this 32X mushroom cloud thing sticking out of the top.
The source uses a perfect word for it. Frankenstein. It was a Frankenstein's monster of hardware, and it was so confusing for consumers.
And expensive. You're spending hundreds on life support for an old machine.
Exactly. But even worse, it split the developer base. If you're a game developer, who are you making a game for? The millions of Genesis owners or the tiny few who own the 32X?
They were fragmenting their own audience.
That's exactly it. They damaged their credibility right before the most important transition in gaming history.
And that leads us to the moment where the wheels just completely come off. The Sega Saturn.
E3, 1995. The source calls this a dark day for Sega.
I can just see it. Sega gets on stage. The pressure is on. They know Sony is coming. So Tom Kalinske has to announce a surprise launch.
Yeah, Saturn is available right now. And the price is $399.
Which is a lot of money in 1995. Over $800 today. But they thought being first would save them?
They thought they could beat Sony to the shelves.
And then maybe the greatest mic drop in corporate history happens.
Sony's Steve Race. He walks on stage right after Sega. Doesn't give a speech, doesn't talk specs. He just leans into the microphone and says one number.
$299.
$299 and walks off.
Brutal. Just absolutely brutal. An instant kill shot.
The room just erupted. But it wasn't even just the price. The source goes into the Saturn's architecture. It had a dual CPU. Two processors.
That sounds good, right? Two brains are better than one?
In theory. But in 1995, it was a nightmare to program for. You had to sync them perfectly. It was incredibly difficult.
So while the PlayStation was easy to work with, the Saturn was like solving a Rubik's Cube just to get a character on screen.
Developers hated it. And on top of all that, where was Sonic?
The big question. You launch a new console without your main guy.
It was the nail in the coffin. There was no true mainline 3D Sonic game at launch. No Mario 64 equivalent. The one thing that could have saved them was missing in action.
It's amazing how fast it all turned. But they weren't done yet. They had one more swing in them. And honestly, this next part breaks my heart a little because I loved this console.
The Dreamcast.
Yes, the Dreamcast. 1999. The source calls it a masterpiece, and I have to agree. It felt like it was from the future.
It was so far ahead of its time. I mean, think about the features Majid highlights. It was the first console with a built-in modem for online play in 1999.
That's revolutionary. This is before Xbox Live, before any of that.
And the VMU.
The visual memory unit, those little memory cards with the screens in them. So weird and cool.
It was innovative. And the games. I mean, Soul Calibur, Shenmue, they looked generations ahead of the PlayStation or N64.
So you have a masterpiece console, online play, incredible games. Why aren't we all playing the Dreamcast 5 today? What happened?
The shadow of the PlayStation 2 happened.
Sony again. The villain of the story.
From Sega's perspective, absolutely. But this time, it wasn't just about price. The analysis in the source points to one decisive factor.
What was it?
The DVD player.
Oh, right. The PS2 could play movies.
And you have to remember what 2000 was like. A standalone DVD player cost maybe $300. The PlayStation 2 cost $299.
So you were basically getting a free DVD player with your game console.
Exactly. It was a Trojan horse. It justified the purchase for the whole family. It was the new home theater system. The Dreamcast only played games.
And they just couldn't match Sony's money either.
No. Sega's finances were drained from the Saturn failure. They couldn't outspend Sony on marketing. And then other things started piling on. EA refused to support the Dreamcast.
Which is huge. No Madden, no FIFA.
Huge. And then there was piracy. The Dreamcast was too easy to copy games for.
So people were playing the games, but Sega wasn't getting the money.
The software sales just plummeted. It was death by a thousand cuts.
And so we get to January 2001, the end of the hardware era.
The announcement. Sega was officially exiting hardware manufacturing to become a third-party publisher.
It's still shocking to think about. That's like Apple saying, we're done making iPhones, we're just going to make apps for Android.
It was exactly that level of shock. But, and this is the important pivot, it wasn't the end of Sega.
Right. Because they're still here, and honestly, they're crushing it.
They evolved. Now a software powerhouse now. I mean, look at the franchises they control. Persona. Yakuza.
Which is like a dragon now, yeah.
And of course, Sonic.
Sonic survived. And now he's running on Nintendo consoles, which is just the ultimate irony.
It is. The character created to destroy Nintendo is now one of their best sellers. You see Mario and Sonic at the Olympics together. If you showed that to someone in 1993, their head would explode.
But it worked. They're profitable. They're relevant. They kept their identity even without the plastic boxes.
Which is so hard to do. Most hardware companies that fail just disappear. Atari, Commodore. Sega kept its soul.
So, looking back on this whole saga, what's the big takeaway from the source?
I think the core lesson is that high performance just isn't enough. The Master System was better tech, the Dreamcast was a masterpiece, but raw specs don't win wars. Long-term survival, it requires good management, savvy marketing, and most importantly, maintaining consumer trust.
And they lost that trust with the Frankenstein add-ons. You can't buy that back once it's gone.
Exactly. You can have the fastest car, but if you drive it off a cliff because you're not watching the road, you still crash.
That's a powerful image. And it brings me to a thought I want to leave you all with. We look at the tech giants of today, right? Companies that seem invincible.
You assume they'll be here forever.
Right. But history tells us that too big to fail is a myth in tech. So looking at the landscape today, which modern tech giant is risking its own Saturn moment? Who is confusing their customers, splitting their audience, or just banking on arrogance instead of utility?
That is the multi-billion dollar question, isn't it?
Something to think about. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the sound of the blue sky. Keep exploring, stay curious, and we'll catch you next time.